May it please the Court. The fairness and efficiency of the criminal justice system depend on the adherence to discovery rules. If defendants can't rely on the government's disclosure, they will be unlikely to plead guilty in cases when it's in their interest to do so, and they won't always be able to test the government's case in a logical way. Lawyers will not be able to prepare. The truth-finding function of the trial will be compromised if parties don't adhere to discovery rules. There is not a serious dispute, as I understand it, that the government's pretrial disclosures in this case violated discovery rules. The government notified the defendant of one statement allegedly made by the defendant, I just borrowed this car from a friend. But at trial, the testimony of the arresting officer was very different. That officer denied that the defendant ever made that statement. He denied ever telling prosecutors that the defendant ever made that statement and testified instead to a very different statement, which was that the defendant denied any connection at all to the vehicle that he had just exited. Rule 16 requires production of the defendant's pretrial statements to officers. And if they follow an interrogation, the record in this case reflects a conversation between the officer and the defendant. So the government essentially produced a statement that the defendant didn't make and failed to produce a statement that, according to its own testimony and closing, the government the defendant did make. This hurts the defendant in two ways. First, the nondisclosure undermined the defendant's position at trial. The defense counsel opened on the I borrowed the statement, the car from a friend statement, and then was undermined when the officer denied that. And second of all, it deprived him of an opportunity to make an informed decision as to his plea. Taking this second species of prejudice first, defendants deciding whether to plead guilty or to go to trial need to be able to rely on the government's disclosures. Here, the government presented a version of the defendant's statement that suggested a defense. I just borrowed the car. A borrowed car can contain items that the defendant might not know about, so this statement suggests a potentially triable case. The true statement, at least according to the government's chief witness, Officer Bennington, was a denial of any connection to the vehicle that the defendant had just exited. Not only does I have no connection to this vehicle not suggest a particularly plausible defense, since the defendant just walked out of the vehicle, according to the government's testimony, it is also in and of itself fairly incriminating because it suggests that the defendant knew that there was something in the car to walk away from. Indeed, the government's attorneys at closing both relied on the defendant's alleged statement denying any connection to the vehicle as evidence of his guilty knowledge at closing. The substantially more attractive.
What is your argument now about prejudice? Tell us about that, how this really prejudiced your client so that you might be entitled even to a mistrial.
Right.
Or is that what you're doing now?
That is what I'm doing. That is what I'm doing now. I'm arguing that the case should be reversed, that the district court erred in failing to produce a mistrial. And the two kinds of prejudice at issue here, one is that the defendant was denied an opportunity to make an informed decision as to his plea. There is record evidence of a plea offer in the case of 10 years, although it didn't come out till sentencing.
Why don't we get to the trial, though? In other words, how did this – because the defendant made an opening statement that says, I'm going to defend this man because he said that he borrowed the automobile from somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's bottom is the fence. And he tells the jury, my client borrowed this automobile from somebody. And he's relying on the police, the government's report on that, or the pretrial discovery. And then all of a sudden, the jury, he turns around and says, no, that's not what it is at all. because he denied he even had anything to do with it. Now that makes the defense attorney a liar in front of the jury.
That's what it does.
You know, it seems to me that, I mean, he was lying to the jury. One, he had to change his lies. But anyway,
I think that's that the defense attorney was dramatically undercut by promising the jury something that he couldn't deliver. The government has suggested that the stipulation, this information was provided to the defendant in.
Question about the stipulation. How did you come up with a stipulation? Stipulation to me normally means that the parties agree. There's a statement themselves. So you're here objecting to all this. What happened? Tim, how'd you get there? What did the defendant object to, and why were you stipulating something?
Well, the defendant objected to the discovery violation and asked for as a remedy first a misdemeanor.
Sure. But then what we're dealing with is a remedial response to that non-disclosure. The trial judge is trying to figure out how to correct it, and then the stipulation tells me that the parties agreed. Well, let's tell the jury this. Is that not what happened?
The defendant said that's better than nothing, but he said, my first preference is a mistrial, and my second preference is to exclude the testimony about this evidence, but if you're not going to give me anything else, I'll take the stipulation.
Okay, that's what I'm asking, what happened, yeah.
So that's, you know, I don't think that there's any reasonable case that the stipulation is a waiver of the defendant's to a more vigorous remedy.
Let me ask you about the language of it. I'm not sure I understand this. The government will stipulate that when we sent the defense counsel notice of a certain statement that, as Mr. Marshall stated to one of the officers that night, the statement was that he just borrowed the car and that none of the officers today remember that statement. What is that?
It doesn't seem particularly helpful. It strikes me as a little bit confusing, but at most it tells them that a discovery email was sent to the.
Yeah, but you agreed to the language.
Sure. I mean, you can't
complain about confusion about language if the jury was confused about the language.
Well, I think I can argue that the stipulation didn't accomplish the.
Yeah, but you agreed to it.
We agreed to the language. I don't think that ought to prevent me from saying that this did not rectify the violation.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay.
But I'm just saying, as far as the language is concerned.
Okay.
I thought it was awfully weak sort of language from the prosecutor's point of view. It could have demanded a lot more because the district judge indicated he was willing to go with some very strong language that would inculpate the government significantly about the mistake.
Well, I mean, I guess suppose the stipulation could have been a little more vigorous. At most, what it told the jury was that a discovery email had been sent. It didn't say the defendant made this statement, and I don't think the record reflects that the prosecution would have been willing to concede that the defendant made this. I just borrowed the statement.
Did anybody ever track down the source of this misstatement? In other words, how did they, if the police officer himself did not hear the statement, and he was the one quoted, how did the misquote get in there?
It's a mystery. I mean, there's a suggestion that it might have come from an officer Solaire, but the officer himself, through a conversation that happened during a break, said he doesn't remember that, and there simply isn't.
The report. And the government indicated that this particular police officer is one that made the statement, that heard the statement, correct?
No, I don't think so. I think the email, discovery email, simply said the defendant made the statement, and then the one officer that came on the stand said, not to me, I didn't hear that. There was no other officer that seemed to have a conversation with the defendant.
There were other officers on the scene? There were other officers.
There was an officer Taylor who searched the car, and there was an officer Solaire who I think interacted with the defendant but had no recollection of the case.
When was the plea bargaining extended, and when was it withdrawn, if it was?
The plea negotiations are not extensively documented, so I don't know. I think the record, and the government hasn't affirmatively conceded that such an offer was made. The record.
Well, the record said that the defendant says that the counsel said I would have taken the 120 months. Basically, he says it cost him five years. Because I wouldn't have gone to trial. I'd have taken the 120 months instead of the 180 minimum I got.
Well, counsel didn't say that. The counsel said, I mean, to be honest with you, counsel said there was an offer made. At sentencing, he said there was an offer made for 120 months. Why don't you give him that? And then he didn't get that. So that's my argument now before you that the outcome could have been different.
Well, I assume the time sequence of that bothered me, because I'm focusing at the moment on prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggests that it cost him 5 years because he would have pled the case out if he had known the truth. But it's on Friday evening before trial that this statement's made. So I assume at that point he's already rejected the plea.
I think that the statement of the defense counsel was that it was made the eve of trial.
Friday before Monday is kind of the eve of trial, isn't it?
I don't know. I think if there's confusion on the subject and the court believes this is dispositive, it could remand to develop the record on that point, so that there's better facts to determine that. That's within the court's power to do. But even if the court is not inclined to do that, I think that...
Well, if the record is deficient, what's your argument for prejudice that the trial would have been different? The jury would have acquitted him?
That it so undermined his position at trial that we can't know what the outcome of the trial would have been. The standard that's set for prejudice in Ible is that was the undisclosed statement substantially more inculpatory on a contested element than the disclosed statement, and the reason that is the standard there is because you have to reset the entire trial preparation.
If you put it like that, then the defendant had to set his defense on the fact that he denied he had anything to do with the white Tahoe, and you had a police officer that said he's the only one that got into it, and then you had the keys that were found in the place where he was sitting. So that wouldn't have been a very successful defense if he had tried to build a defense around that, would it?
Well,
and he was a tall fellow and had adjusted the seat to his height.
Yeah.
Well, on the record that was developed with the defense preparing for an entirely different case, it doesn't look like that. But the way that Ible gauges prejudice is to compare the statements, not to look at the entire record we just can't know how the parties would have prepared to meet evidence that if the disclosures had been entirely different.
Yeah, but you have to make a plausible argument why it would have made a difference.
In addition to the question of whether the defendant would have been more inclined to take a plea, the plausible argument is that the defense counsel would have prepared to meet a different set of evidence in the case.
that doesn't get you anywhere. That's the first step on a three or four step journey you got to take.
There isn't, for instance, in Ible, a discussion of whether or not the case would have been defensible in light of the disclosed statement. The disclosed statement in Ible is effectively a confession to the offense. I don't think that if the court were simply saying, does the record evidence developed in this trial suggest a defense to the to the undisclosed statement that the outcome in Ible would have been the same. Harm is evaluated in a different way in the case of discovery violation.
Okay, Mr. Page, you've saved some time for rebuttal. Mr. McKay for the government.
May it please the Court, Brian McKay on behalf of the United States. This Court should affirm because Mr. Marshall has not shown any basis to overturn his conviction.
Mr. McKay, let me ask you about the origin of that email on Friday evening. What was the basis for that?
The prosecutor had spoken with the officers in final preparation for trial, had previously interviewed the officers, but in final discussions, this statement had apparently been made that Mr. Marshall said he had borrowed the car. And then that Friday evening, within about, I think, 2 hours of that statement being made to the prosecutor, she sent the disclosure that indicated that statement had been made, as well as some others that aren't the subject of the appeal.
Well, who made it? The prosecutor did not know or remember who made those statements?
The disclosure said that the statement was made to an officer. Now, during the bench conference outside the presence of the jury, she had in assuring the district court that this wasn't an issue where she had intentionally misrepresented or anything like that. In assuring that to the court said, now, did you intend that it was your understanding that that's what this officer had said, meaning Officer Benight? And she said, yes. It was my understanding that Officer Benight had said that Marshall reported borrowing the vehicle. But the evidence, even setting aside what Marshall said that night, whether he borrowed the car or whether he knew nothing about it, the other evidence in this case proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the driver of that Tahoe knew of the gun inside. And it also proved that Marshall was that driver.
Yeah, before you leave that, some officer must have told her that. Somebody had to say that. I mean, I'm assuming that. I'm sure she wouldn't make it up. So it's a miscommunication. I still don't quite get how they. This goes to the question of the nature of the non-disclosure. Is it the inadvertence or whatever it is? And it's not just the prosecutor. It's also it's the government that we're talking about non-disclosure and what. How that came about, but none of that's a record.
The stipulation certainly, I think, leads to the inference that the officer told the prosecutor of the borrowing statement, and then once at trial, under oath, said no, that was never said. He disclaimed any knowledge of it.
Well, that's a very significant statement. it just takes away the government. The government had not proved it validates most of the government's case. I mean, they said they borrowed it. I mean, he does have that car. Those were his keys. So on and so forth. It hangs it all on the fact that he borrowed it, which is going to be easily dispatched because the owner is going to say, I don't know the guy.
Well, I disagree
that's an enormously important statement to a defense counsel, isn't it?
I think it is something that defense counsel would take into account, but it's not the heart of this case. The focus of the case was whether on the driver, whoever that may be, did the driver know of the gun inside? And even defense counsel recognized.
What it suggests to me is that, and it goes back to this plea bargain business. I don't know if plea bargain had anything to do with it or not. That's why I was trying to get the timeline out of it. But it sounded to me like that he'd already rejected pleas by Friday evening, and you're going on to trial. But if that's in which event, I think that's off the table. But the record doesn't show that one way or the other.
The record certainly does not show that, and I think that corroborates the fact that turn, whether he said he knew nothing about the car or whether he had borrowed it, that wasn't material to counsel's advice about taking a plea or the defendant's decision. And I want to make clear that the reference to that plea offer during sentencing wasn't done in a way that defense argued that the variance would have changed his plea. What he was arguing at that time in talking about the plea offer was in trying to get the district court to look past the predicate offenses that established the 15-year mandatory minimum.
Well, if I had defense counsel and my client, I found out that my client has told him that I borrowed the car, that just closed all kinds of doors. I mean, and I'm sure going to be plea bargaining for sure. I mean, because what else is he going to do? I mean, here's this fellow in this car, and then all the government's got to show is that the owner said, I've never seen this guy in my life. It's over.
I don't disagree that the evidence was strong. The government had to do two things, put Mr. Marshall in the vehicle, and then show that once in the vehicle, the person who was in that vehicle knew of the gun, and because of the open console, there in plain view, in a well-lit interior, in plain view was the revolver, and it was sitting upright, you know, precariously balanced. And the prosecutor argued at close that the only reasonable inference was that that gun was placed there after the vehicle came to arrest. And I agree that that evidence showing that the driver knew of the gun inside, that was strong. But there's no indication that the fact of whether he borrowed it or whether he said that he knew nothing about it was material to the decision to plea. He never, for example, during trial, he never suggested this variety of prejudice, and he never sought a continuance to maybe re-engage the government and explore his options for pleading at that point. And I would commend to the court the Martinez case from the Tenth Circuit cited in the government's brief, where they noted that very fact in addressing a very similar claim of prejudice.
Well, the argument that's been made is that he would have accepted the plea agreement had he known that, but that implicit in that is that the offer was still open.
And that's not clear in the record, but it is my understanding in candor to the court that the offer was open until the time of trial.
Yeah. Well, what's the answer to that then?
And again, that if that
that's five,
if
you're talking about 5 years,
if that was material to the decision, then counsel certainly could have asked for a continuance and re-engage the government.
Why isn't it material?
It's not material because whether he said he borrowed it or whether he disclaimed it didn't matter. Even if we accept that there was a defense argument and counsel in the bench conference explicitly recognized, well, Judge, we still have this issue of the gun's placement. He knew that was the heart of the case, and that's what was argued. So even if he had said from the beginning, and even if, as the district court concluded in denying the motion for new trial, even if Officer Benight had said, he reported that he borrowed the car, the evidence still showed, it was very strong, that just placing him in the car, whether it was because it was borrowed or whether because he was being dishonest about it, regardless, once he was placed in the car, the driver of that Tahoe knew of the gun inside. He knew of the gun inside because in that well-lit interior, there in an open console, very unusual position, as Officer Taylor had testified, people don't drive around with the console of the car open.
Let me go back to a little different angle on it, and that is whether there may be a structural defect here in the sense that you effectively made a liar of the defendant's counsel, and from that point forward, there was never effective counsel for the defendant because the jury immediately dismissed him because he had said, I'm going to prove that he borrowed it from somebody. I'm going to prove that he did not borrow it from somebody. And then they come up and say, well, he never said that. There's no evidence of that anyway when his counsel has based his case on that. That seems like that really undercuts any effectiveness that the counsel may have had.
I understand that that's an attractive argument. Now, first I would say, and it's clear from Arcentellis, that degree of prejudice doesn't rise to the significant amount that warrants a new trial. But also, as in Arcentellis, this court has recognized that type of prejudice can be dissipated completely by simply explaining to the jury what had happened. And that's precisely what was done here. Once the prosecutor got up and explained to the jury, we disclosed a statement to defense counsel.
Yeah, but I don't know that that's exactly in point with the other cases. And if he had never said anything about it, I quite agree with you. But if he bottomed his entire case and rested his credibility to the jury on the misrepresentation that the government had made, and once that misrepresentation is clarified, he becomes, in effect, a discredited lawyer that the jury is never going to believe his case. I mean, it's...
And I don't agree. Once the jury heard why counsel had made that statement in opening and understood that it wasn't because of any... that counsel wasn't misleading the jury or hadn't lied to the jury, once they understood that, they weren't sitting there wondering like the jury in Arcentellis was. They understood why that statement had been made, and they wouldn't hold that against defense counsel.
Wait a minute. Let me stop there. You got a jury to box, and the guy says, he stands up in front of the jury and tells them this, and then you come back and say, well, there was no basis for that. So then the question is, well, then why did he state that? I mean, the defendant knew where they borrowed the car or not, and so what it says to me is that you guys, this defense lawyer just jumped on this statement by the government and decided to cling to that, when if his client had not was innocent, he would never have said that. I mean, you would never have accepted those statements. You would have challenged those statements.
Well, I think just as...
And then he accepted those statements and was now making it his defense. And then suddenly that goes, well, to me, that just...
Well, I think that just as quickly what the stipulation did was it created a prior inconsistent statement on behalf of Officer Benai, which under Rule 613, defense counsel took advantage of and was a feature of closing argument and a reason to discredit Officer Benai's testimony in toto.
What did... the defense attorney say to the jury an opening statement? Did he say, this is, the truth of this matter is that what? He did not borrow the car. He did not have anything to do with the car. Is that what?
In opening statements?
Yeah, what did the defense?
In opening statements, he said that the evidence would show that he told officers that night that he had just borrowed the car.
And what did he say the evidence would actually show with respect to the car? Did he or did he not borrow it, or did he not have anything to do with it?
I don't recall, but I don't believe he credited anything other than the fact that he borrowed the car.
Well, look at the stipulation. It doesn't say that. It just says that the officers don't remember it now.
Correct. And that's...
They don't. What it doesn't say is the officer never said that.
Correct. The stipulation doesn't.
What that does, it left the government off the hook.
Well,
it does, because what it says is the officer, it lets the prosecutor off the hook, because it says that they just don't remember it now. The implication of that is that, well, maybe they said it and maybe they didn't, but they don't remember it now.
I think, well, first of all, the district court perceived this stipulation as having thrown the prosecution under the bus.
I'm sorry.
And the district court perceived this stipulation as having thrown the prosecutor under the bus. He didn't think it was letting the government off. And certainly the takeaway from the stipulation is that the officer had said one thing previously and said something different at trial. And that's certainly whether it was could be perceived any other way, that's certainly what was credited in defense counsel's closing arguments.
Well, it's one thing to say the officers don't remember that statement now, but if you're going to take it out of the case, you're going to say the government has no evidence that, in fact, the defendant made any statement regarding borrowing the car or not.
And that may be. And
that puts the government in a neutral kind of position.
And as this court has recognized, you know, we can quibble about the language of this particular stipulation.
Quibble about it because the question is whether or not that particular stipulation sufficiently takes the prejudice out of the case. That's not a quibble. That's the case.
I understand. And if we look at Davila, Arcentellis, others, it's not merely what was done and what was the language of this stipulation, but also what could have been done shy of a mistrial. The district court is to employ a remedy that's the least severe sanction that's going to address the issue, and that's precisely what the court did. And if the court had, you know, if defense counsel could have agreed or pushed for a stronger stipulation, maybe he would have gotten that. But it would be an odd result if here, he could agree to a, in his view, weak stipulation, use that stipulation to batter the officer in closing arguments in hope of getting an acquittal, but know that if he doesn't get an acquittal and instead gets a conviction, he'll have a quote-unquote weak stipulation in his back pocket for appeal. I think that would be an odd result. Marshall also argues, in his brief at least, that the government had featured the stipulation, or the disclaimer, in its closing arguments. And he points to cases like Jackson and Tirado and Alvarado to contend that when that happens, a new trial is warranted. And I want to point out, because it's not clear in the government's brief, that that's a very misleading argument. It's misleading both factually and legally. Misleading factually because to characterize the government as having relied on this disclaimer in closing argument is simply not supported by the record. When I review the prosecutor's closing arguments, I see that she credited, in discussing the evidence for the jury, she noted Officer Benight's testimony and the fact that he watched Marshall get out of the car, the keys that were in the floorboard of the Volvo, which Marshall had gotten into walking away from the Tahoe after he saw a marked police car in the parking lot. She stressed Officer Taylor's testimony that once he got in the car, he saw there in plain view in the open console the gun that was precariously balanced. And she argued that all of that evidence showed that Marshall knowingly possessed the gun. And only after wrapping all that together for the jury did she make a passing reference to the disclaimer. And she did so not to stress the...
But what was that passing reference to the disclaimer?
She had said when he said he knew nothing about the car, it was consistent, my paraphrase, I can find it if it would be helpful, but it was consistent with his verbal disclaimer. She noted it in passing to reinforce his behavioral disclaimer of walking away from the car. And that was not heavy reliance like what has caused new trials in the past. But even if we accept that even passing reference suggested to the jury that they should credit the disclaimer at all, that was wiped away on rebuttal when the other prosecutor stood up and from the beginning said, this isn't about whether he borrowed the car, and it doesn't matter whether he said this or whether he said that. Don't get sidetracked by that issue. Instead, look at the other evidence that shows he was the one who drove it, and the driver, whether it was borrowed or not, the driver knew of the gun inside. That was proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So contrary to suggesting that the government featured this in closing or heavily relied on it, to the contrary, the government specifically de-emphasized the disclaimer in closing argument. And I think the Mr. Marshall's argument is legally misleading in that he's relying on cases that don't arise in the Rule 16 context. Well, first of all, those cases are distinguishable for the very reason I just talked about. In those cases, there was a prosecutor who relied on infirm evidence. In one case, in Jackson, the prosecutor argued that evidence alone established proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't have that, as I was just explained. But also, it's misleading because those aren't Rule 16 cases. In those cases, a different harmlessness standard applies that's very exacting and very demanding. And we know that that standard doesn't apply. We know that from Arcentelis, from Eibel, from Pasquale, from Garcia, and the several others that do arise in the Rule 16 context. I want to stress that the trial that occurred in this case, the focus of it was whether there was a reasonable doubt that the person who drove the car, whether it was borrowed or whether the person knew nothing about it, the focus of that case was whether that driver knew of the gun inside. And despite best efforts, defense counsel could not raise a reasonable doubt on that issue in light of the government's strong physical evidence. Disclosure of the disclaimer before trial would not have shifted this case, the focus of this case, such that the legal strategy would have been materially different, nor would it have changed his decision about his plea. The district court was correct when it concluded in on the motion for new trial that the disclosure, the variance between the disclosure and the in-trial testimony, that there was no reasonable doubt that it did not alter I'm sorry, that there was no reasonable probability that it altered the outcome of this trial. And for that reason, I would ask the court to affirm.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McKay. Mr. Page, we'll hear from you next on rebuttal.
Well, the government has commendably acknowledged that the plea offer in this case was open until trial, which means that there is a possibility that the defendant could have received a lesser sentence if the trial had not appeared as attractive as it did in light of the government's disclosures. If there's any doubt about whether or not the defendant would have taken that trial, that record is not developed, but it could be on a limited remand, or the court could simply conclude that the record evidence is sufficient to demonstrate that a sufficient probability to reverse the conviction and remand the case. There is a possibility of a different outcome if the defense counsel had not been undercut in his opening statement, although there probably wasn't a way, I'll concede there probably wasn't a way for the defendant to prove that he didn't exit the vehicle. The defense counsel could have said, well, my client lied about the car because it was a stolen car, and argued that.
What it was offered was Officer Benight the source of the misinformation to the prosecutor?
We don't know. There just isn't any evidence. There isn't, and because of that, there isn't really a good explanation.
Well, then how did the prosecutor learn that the statement was inaccurate?
How did the prosecutor learn that the statement was inaccurate? On the witness stand, I assume, when Officer Benight.
Prosecutor put the witness up and didn't know what he's going to say?
We just don't know. That's a possibility that the officer surprised the prosecutor, or it's possible that there was a grave miscommunication during the conference, or I don't know. I can't explain.
But we did know that the prosecutor didn't find out about it until the witness testified, and that's when the whole issue arose, and she went back into chambers and apparently said to the judge, I mean, I thought he did say what was in that memo, and I'm sorry.
Well, the prosecutor said, did not really make an affirmative statement that.
Trying to get I'm in a little trouble getting the narrative down. Prosecutor is preparing for trial Friday evening, sends the email. And then, presumably, she's talking to the witness.
Right.
And that's Benight. And she puts Benight on there, witness, and he denies it. He said, no, that was never said. So were there some other witnesses?
There was an officer, Solaire, who did not testify, who was on suspension and did not appear in court, and there was some explanation that he was not permitted to appear due to Dallas PD policy because he was under suspension. I don't know. I don't know if that is the part of the reason he didn't appear.
He was the source of the statement?
We don't know that. But he says he has no recollection of the matter. So it's simply a mystery in the upshot.
I thought the Rule 16 disclosure would be triggered, duty would be triggered by the requirement that you disclose the statements of your witness. So this other person was not going to be the witness. He was suspended and couldn't testify. So Benight was the witness from jump start.
The Rule 16 obligation in this case was triggered by the obligation to disclose the defendant's oral statements to.
That's right, but that oral statement was to an officer.
Correct.
Which means that Benight was presumably the person there.
Well, if assuming that the.
I'm just trying.
I think there's a discovery violation in two ways. One, by not disclosing the denial of the of any connection to the vehicle, which was a statement that the government relied on in its case, and second of all, by disclosing a statement that apparently was not made, that there is no evidence that the borrowing statement was actually ever made.
Well, the prosecutor surely on Friday evening wasn't talking to a witness, an officer who was suspended and couldn't testify. or not. Maybe it's, so, well, we don't know now much of anything, do we?
not really on this record. So I would simply suggest to you that the particular facts of this case show that a defense counsel was badly undercut in his strategy, this cannot be termed a fair trial. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Page, thank you very much. Call the next case of the day.